and our text then to guide us as we make our way through comparing religions of the world. That's our summer series. Today we're comparing Hinduism and Christianity. I just want to refresh your memories on several verses which go to the heart of Hinduism, beginning at verse 19 of 1 Corinthians 10. What do I imply then? That food offered to idols is anything, or that an idol is anything? No. I imply that what pagan sacrifice they offer to demons and not to God. I do not want you to be participants with demons. You cannot drink the cup of the Lord and the cup of demons. You cannot partake of the table of the Lord and the table of demons. Shall we provoke the Lord to jealousy? Are we stronger than He? Precisely what Hindus do. They, part of their family rituals, their rituals as Hindus, is establishing a family altar with idols. Now they say, as many Catholics do, that the idols, they don't worship the actual idols, they worship the spiritual beings behind them. And we'll unpack that a little bit more as we go along. But this text is apt for Hinduism. In December of 2009, the animated 3D movie Avatar was released to great acclaim, box office success. I remember seeing that movie over Christmas as we were with family. It was called Avatar because the premise of the movie was that a human soul or personality could enter into the living body of a humanoid being of another planet. And of course, in that particular movie, it was Pandora. It was actually a moon of a planetary system. This human soul or personality then could live his life through that being's body. The movie is set in the year 2254, when ostensibly this could be achieved. The word avatar is a Hindu Sanskrit word, meaning the descent of a god into human form, or a manifestation or phase of that god's being. That goes right to the heart of what we're talking about today. Well, in the movie Avatar, a struggle ensues between human forces mining precious resources from this idyllic paradise of a moon. And of course, they're destroying the environment of the place as they do it. Does that resonate with a movement that we know, right, in our own time and place? And the blue-skinned humanoids who live in harmony with that nature, they're in conflict with this. They also worship a mother goddess called Aiwa. The humans employ avatars to stir up controversy among the Na'vi. These are the blue humanoids that scatter about the planet. And they're trying to persuade them to leave the moon or otherwise stir up trouble. The avatars fit in with these beings, thinking, willing, living amongst them. And one of them, Jake, is troubled by all of this and he turns renegade, siding with the Na'vi in their struggle. There's a little bit for everyone. I enjoyed the movie. It was a rollicking good tale, except for the politics, but you can filter that out, right? There's dragons. There's huge living trees where entire civilizations live and rely on it for sustenance. There's really evil bad guys who love to destroy. There's armies who sweep onto screen in 3D. There's true love, twists of plot, a heavily biased environmental message that hits you upside the head. My favorite portion of the movie was when my son, John Luke, who was in his junior year at West Point, just learning military tactics, John Luke was the only one who cheered when the army attacked. The army's crushing the forest and beings in it, everything with tanks and machines, and John is, yeah, yeah. And there's even a happy ending, of course, where Jake is transferred into his avatar body with the aid of the Tree of Souls at the conclusion of the film. What impresses me is how true to the concept of Avatar the movie is. It's exactly what the text of Hindu Sanskrit, the Bhagavad Gita, the Upanishads, the Rig Veda, is exactly what these writings had in mind when they wrote of their gods in manifestation. The argument of modern Hinduism is that there is only one God who manifests in many millions of forms and phases as an inhabitant of an avatar, depending upon what phase or facet of being he or she wishes to bring into being. So if the creative force of the universe is to be shown, then Brahman is the God, for example, one of the avatars of the All Soul. If the preserving and saving aspect is uppermost, then Vishnu is the God. If the destructive forces of the universe come into play, there must always be destruction before creation and renewal, then Vishnu is the God. Then Shiva is the God. But in the end, according to the consensus of most Hindu teachers today, it hasn't always been this way, all are but avatars of the one supreme being. So, my question to you today is, did you know you were being introduced to basic religious concepts in this major Hollywood production? Seeing it. It's been successfully smuggled in, if not. Were you aware of the inculcation of Hindu thought, albeit in a dumbed-down New Age version? The producer and the screenwriters were deliberately attempting. So this is one reason we want to continue this series on the major world religions, because you're getting spoon-fed Hinduism, whether you realize it or not, in our New Age culture. You have a place for notes on the inside flap of your bulletin. And I'd like to ask you, point one, how do the some 8 million gods of Hinduism compare to the one God of Christianity? That's always our first question. If I choose this major world religion, who do I worship, or what do I worship? I'm conservative by nature, so I give you the low end of estimates that some Hindu gurus give for the number of gods in their pantheon, 8 million. The higher end is 350 million gods. They try to cover their bases. Like Paul at Mars Hill, right? Saying, hey, I know a God. I know a God to the unknown God you have here, all the other gods surrounding us. And they were prolific in the ancient world. Pagans and Christians. Go downstairs, William Lane Fox. I still have that in my library. He chronicled, book is about that thick. He chronicles the transition from paganism to Christianity, and he says the cities of the ancient world were just stocked and packed. You could hardly move your elbows without knocking over an idol. It's still that way in India. 350 million potential gods. That's quite a discrepancy, though. 8 million or 350 million? But for the Hindus, it's no problem. Discrepancies and contradictions abound in Hinduism. Cognitive dissonance is a regular feature for Westerners as they study Hinduism. Walt Whitman famously said, do I contradict myself? Very well, then I contradict myself. I am large. I contain multitudes, unquote. Now, Whitman could very well have been a Hindu whose thought he studied, though not in much depth, at the height of the transcendental movement in America and in the 19th century. To say that A is B, while at the same time asserting A is not B and holding that both are true in the same place and at the same time, which is the very definition of contradiction, is no problem for Walt Whitman and the Hindus. This is why you can have under the same theological umbrella one who says God is one, expressing himself in multiple avatars, and another who says there is no one God but many, in essence. Both kinds of Hindus are happy and content to call themselves such, and they see no problem in the other guy saying so too. Try that with Arminianism and Calvinism, or an Arian and a Trinitarian, or an Augustinian and a Pelagian. That's why we have cognitive dissonance when we come to the table of Hinduism. Logic is central to biblical Christianity, and then consequently to Western thought. As the Encyclopedia of World Religions puts it, Hindus believe in an uncreated, eternal, infinite, transcendent principle that comprises itself being in being and non-being, in being and non-being, and is the sole reality, the ultimate cause and foundation, the source and goal of all existence, unquote. Did you get that? Sounds a little New Agey, isn't it? Well, New Ageism is derived largely from Hinduism. Now, this single track with me on this, all right? It's important to understanding the nature of Hinduism. This single reality is called philosophically monism. Now, I just lost a bunch of you. You're ready to nod off. Well, I'll take a nap through this part of the sermon, right? No, don't. Philosophical monism is at the heart of Hinduism, since there's no other transcendent being or reality affecting it. Classically in religion, this idea of monism is called pantheism. Pantheistic religions, Hinduism, Exhibit A. That is, that God is all and all is God. What we see in the world as distinctions and differences are ultimately an illusion in pantheism. Okay? At the opposite end of the spectrum is dualism. There are dualistic religions out there too. Philosophically, dualism we call it, which pits two equally opposite forces against one another, or perhaps as complementary. Classically, things like good versus evil, light versus dark, pain versus pleasure, male versus female. In the East, you see this as yin and yang. New Agers love the yin and the yang, don't they? And you got that symbol all over the place. Or perhaps in Zoroastrianism, which has its origins in Iran, the pagan religion that was there before Islam came sweeping through. Zoroastrianism has a duality between the good god Mazda and the evil god Mainyu, and they are in eternal conflict one with the other, always equally opposing one against the other. Once again, origins in Iran. And St. Augustine fought this in Manichaeism. Some of you who went through St. Augustine's confessions with us a couple years ago now, remember that he went through the Manichaean phase when Mani brought much of what would become Zoroastrianism into Christianity, tried to make a syncretistic religion out of Christianity and Manichaeism. Still with me? Not too many of you are nodding off, are we? Biblical Christianity does not fall into either trap, monism or dualism. The one who has expressed this most successfully, I think, is R.C. Sproul. He calls it the biblical binary. Not classical dualism, but a biblical binary. Biblical binary recognizes the creator-creature, the creator-creation distinction. So it has perhaps an initial appearance of dualism, but it is not classical philosophical dualism. He calls it biblical binary. Yet this binary recognizes that these are not two co-equal forces, but that the creator is sovereign over his creation, including the forces of darkness and of evil, of destruction and chaos. He is supreme and sovereign over them. They are not two co-equal gods, two co-equal forces. Satan is a creature over whom God is sovereign. Well, not so Hinduism. Is your head hurting yet? Hinduism is classically pantheistic, and it shares much in common with Buddhism. We saw Buddhism last week. Buddhism is classically a reform of Hinduism, which is why also parenthetically we will combine the treatment of the fruits that we also look at What are the fruits of the religion that I am adopting? So next week, we'll look at the fruits of Buddhism and Hinduism combined, because they're so closely intertwined, these two religions. So the goal of pantheistic Hinduism is the union of the Atman, they call it. The Atman in Sanskrit means what we perceive as the individual human personality. Each of us think, well, I'm me, I know that. I have my own individual character and personality. Well, Hindus say that's merely an illusion. It is the Atman that we perceive. And the ultimate goal is the union of this Atman with the Brahman, which is the monistic all, which is God. That's why we call Hinduism pantheism. Because all of what we see, all of creation, is monistic. That it is all God. We are all God. If we just perceive ourselves one of another, that we are all God, there is God in all of us. I'm sounding more and more New Agey as I go along, isn't it? But New Age philosophy is in its essence Hindu. The Encyclopedia of World Religion says once again, one may learn this lesson, that is, that we are all God. We are all part of a monistic whole. One may learn this lesson by different means. By realizing one's essential sameness with all living beings, by responding in love to a personal expression of the divine, or by coming to appreciate that the competing attentions and moods of one's waking consciousness are grounded in a transcendental unity. I see some of the same looks that I had when I first read this. So much of this language sounds New Agey, precisely because Western New Age thought, if we can call it that, is grounded in Hinduism. Therefore, when you hear all of the language of oneness with life, the divine in all things, the importance of becoming enlightened, you must understand its essential pantheistic nature. And why it sounds so strange to Western and in particular Christian ears. It is also why you find no evidence of an infinite personal God, too. We keep listening for that. Maybe they'll talk about the infinite personal God that we know and love, who wants to redeem or save us. No, you won't hear any of that in Hinduism. If, indeed, granted their premise, pantheistic premise, if all is one and one is all, you are me and I am you. I'm sounding more and more like John Lennon all the time. And we are all of one another, right? And the Beatles, quite frankly, right? When you remember the pictures of the gurus that the trips to the India and so forth, they were pantheistic to the core. They were mediating to us, giving us a bland form of Hinduism through their music. Well, if all of these pantheistic assumptions are true, then a thing like the infinite personal creator God of the Bible is only an illusion created by the Atman, that is what we perceive as the individual self, which ultimately is only an expression of the greater Brahman, the ultimate one, or the God. It is why Hinduism is so dismissive of Christianity. Why it prides itself on being the oldest world religion, consequently the truest of all the world's faith. To the Hindu, Christianity is a recent upstart. The Christian only has a 2,000-year-old faith, while Hinduism ostensibly stretches back to the foggy mist of human origins, as recorded in the Vedas. The Vedas, the set of writings of Hinduism. These writings are over 3,000 years old, and they're composed in ancient Sanskrit, a beautiful looking written language. But Brian, you think you're having a tough time with Hebrew? Try Sanskrit. The morphology of Sanskrit is impenetrable. I tried spending a little time trying to learn the morphology and the the alphabet of Sanskrit, and it's impossible. Well, the Vedas, that is the collection of writings, include comparable, if you will, comparable to our text, our Bible, right? The Rig Veda, here is the Rig Veda, translated into English. It is a series of poems, really, in Sanskrit. And you know, poetry is always the hardest thing to understand in any language. And the poetry of Hinduism, the Rig Veda, is even more impenetrable than the impenetrable Upanishads. The Upanishads are the second set of books, five major books gathered into the Upanishads. And then there's the Bhagavad Gita. And then there are the Puranas as well. Those are the four major sets of the Veda, the written texts of Hinduism. And to Western ears and eyes, this body of literature is foreign and bewildering. But these writings are from whence all of Hinduism is derived, at least in its intellectual apprehension. Discerning the essence of it for us, the essence of Hinduism from these writings, would be like taking the corpus of Western literature and attempting to reconstruct biblical Christianity from it without the Bible. We might be able to make some progress, right, in Western literature along those lines, but only for the most well-versed. Well, so it is in Hinduism. So do not dismiss any of this, I would suggest to you. Hinduism is not just New Ageism elevated a notch or two. No. It is ancient. It is complex. It is cultured. The culture of Hinduism has determined many and many a nation in the East, especially on the Hindu India subcontinent. And it's rich with tradition. Hindus are very proud, and rightly so, of their culture and tradition. In fact, one of the strongest opponents of militant Islam, too, we should be thankful for this, is the militant Hindu. Many militant Hindus have been elected to the Indian Parliament recently. They take a lot of militant Muslims off our back, if you will, by killing a lot of militant Muslims. Many militant Hindus have been elected to the Indian Parliament here recently. Rajnath Singh, you may have heard his name if you follow the news closely. And some extremists go so far as to commit acts of terror in the name of Hinduism. They're a small minority, euphemistically called saffron terror. You know, they wear the saffron robes all the time, and it's called saffron terror. But unlike Islam, mainline Hindus do reject them as well. And they do what they can to marginalize them and to crush them when they can. All that in mind, this resurgence of Hindu nationalism in India has spawned persecution of Christians too. That's the downside. The persecution of Christians sporadically over the last several decades. Christian property has been destroyed. There's been burning of Bibles, raping of nuns, murder of Christian clergy, forced reconversions. The Voice of the Martyrs chronicles this. If you get a chance to pick up a copy or two, once in a while they will cover the militant Hindu in India who is doing these things. Well, the reason they're so upset with Christians is because they've bent over backwards to accommodate you. Oh, Christian, the Indian government has officially adopted Jesus Christ as one of their gods. What more do you want? But yeah, you remember what that means to a Hindu, right? Jesus is now a recognized avatar in the pantheon of these some 350 million manifestations of the All, the One, the Brahman. Therefore, the Hindu sees no reason why Christians cannot become loyal Hindus. Since it is common practice in Hinduism, we'll cover this a little more next week, to single out one of the manifestations of the All and then personify him in this pantheon of Hindu gods for your favorite particular devotion. In every Hindu home, you'll find an idol or two, an idol or two or three or four that, and we'll cover this in more detail next week, that they bathe, that they feed, that they clothe. You can do that with Jesus and be a loyal Hindu. Why, Christians, are you so stubborn and insistent and narrow in insisting that he is the exclusive and only way to the infinite personal God? With which they have further misunderstandings and problems too. They would say the infinite personal God of the Bible is only another avatar, another expression of the All or the Brahman. Well then, given this understanding of the divine for the Hindu, how does he see salvation? More, from what does he need to be saved? Point two. How does the great cosmic wheel of karma compare to the cosmic cross of Christ for salvation? There's a scheme of salvation in every world religion. Bound up with our goal. The goal of the Hindu devotee is to become one with the All, with the Brahman, though paradoxically, he already is. Once again, we saw in Buddhism as well now in Hinduism, there are paradoxes, there are contradictions in the religion. We are one with the All. It is just that we do not realize this yet. So your goal then is to become one with the All, in full realization or enlightenment of it. It is just that in his manifestation of his individual self, all of us, the Atman, we are inhibited from consciously knowing and living the reality of being one with the All. Therefore, salvation is a path of realization, of enlightenment to what he already is. Salvation is therefore not redemption from what one is. And the Hinduism hates this as much as the Buddhist and the Muslim. We are definitely, emphatically, not a fallen sinner in Hinduism. Original sin is repugnant to the Hindu as it is to the Muslim, as it is to the Buddhist. So salvation is not redemption from what one is to something better. That is a moral and ethical purity or holiness which is intrinsic to the transcendent God we worship, who then, he then transforms this creature made in his image into that state of holiness, which is how we understand redemption and salvation, right? Rather, salvation in Hinduism consists in performing the prescribed works. Where have we seen that before? Performing the prescribed works in order to be saved. You perform the prescribed works that will in turn make of the worshiper a better person, attaining an increasingly higher state of awareness and enlightenment as he does so. This process is given the name Sanatana Dharma. Sanatana Dharma. Sanatana meaning the set of traditional religious rites, duties, and practices of the Hindu, and it's chock full of these kinds of things. Sanatana Dharma, Dharma being the gamut of teachings inculcated by the Veda. So the Sanatana Dharma, in fact, this is the preferred name for this ancient religion for those in the know. So if you really want to sound hip with a Hindu, you call it not Hinduism, but Sanatana Dharma. Hinduism is an entirely Western name given to these sets of ancient, complex teachings and practices. Hinduism for the practitioner of Sanatana Dharma is far too dismissive and shallow and Western to be called Hinduism by the Hindu. British newspapers began using the term Hindu in the early 18th century as they colonized India. to describe the whole region from which these things derive. That is the Indus River Basin. Thus, from the Indus River Basin, we have Hindu. So then, back to our idea of salvation for the Hindu. The Hindu's basic sin, if we can call it that, and it's when I use that word, it's not sin as we understand sin. But the Hindu's basic sin, then, from which he must be saved, is ignorance and unenlightenment. And his forebearers, this is why they follow gurus. Guru has followed guru, and guru has followed the past guru, on infinitum as a hall of mirrors into the ancient past. His forebearers, his gurus, have paved the way to salvation with many paths. Have we heard that before? Which have been reduced to three for the sake of simplicity. These are the three paths of salvation for the Hindu. Number one, the Karma Marga, which is the path of duties, the Karma Marga. In the Karma Marga, one is obligated to do a panoply of complex ritual and social obligations from birth to death. Everything from the cleansing at birth to the cremation at death. Fire is a purifier. And so they feel the final purification is expressed in the cremation of the body. Secondly, there is the Jnana Marga. Jnana Marga, which is the path of knowledge. Here, classically, we see the old sages and gurus in poses of meditation. Yoga falls under this rubric, the path of knowledge. Here, one is taught and expected to practice meditative concentration, in which the devotee is expected to transcend mere intellectual understanding, i.e. contradiction, and understand the oneness of all. You eventually gain insight into your identity with the Brahman, then, through these meditative practices. The third path is the Bhakti Marga. That is the path of devotion. Here, love and devotion to one of the pantheon of Hindu gods from which the devotee might choose. He chooses one that he admires, or perhaps he feels he need to become more like, if he's deficient in compassion, if he's deficient in strength, something along these lines, then he will follow the god that expresses this to increase his good karma. Now, a person can specialize in one of these three paths. That's why you see some of the ascetic gurus half naked in the snow in meditative postures, disciplining their bodies through their minds and so forth. Or you can live a mix of all three, which is what most Hindus do. When one diligently applies these three ways in your life, your behavior and your soul grow more and more into alignment with the cosmos. Your behavior improves, and therefore your karma becomes in line with the Brahman, with the all, with the one. This leads to greater ascension in being through reincarnation. Ding, 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 ding. We're ringing all the bells, aren't we? In New Ageism. We won't get to astrology. Didn't have time, but astrology is a part of this mix. But we'll hit astrology pretty hard when we look at the New Age. This leads then to greater ascension in being through reincarnation, vice versa, too. If for bad behavior, you get bad karma, and you descend into a cockroach or something like that. Part of the larger goal is to escape death and rebirth. When one finally becomes one with the Brahman. So, this has consequence for ethical behavior too. Good and right behavior are not therefore sourced in obedience to a personal God who has revealed his holy will to be obeyed. That's how we understand goodness and right behavior, do we not? But rather, for the Hindu, goodness and right behavior are intrinsic to the nature of the universe, and they carry their own penalties and rewards, like the inherent punishment of burns for touching a hot stove or the inherent reward of a velvet sensation for touching the petal of a rare flower. Karma, one Western professor lecturing on what karma is, describing karma in 4 minutes. You know, that's how we do things. One guru I watch, in he's a yoga guru, he says, I'm fed up with people who come to my seminars and say, Guru, I have 3 days. Enlighten me. It just ignores the discipline of what genuine Hinduism and genuine yoga is. So for the Hindu, goodness and right behavior are intrinsic to the nature of the universe and carry their own penalties and rewards. Karma is that celestial bank, if we can put it that way. Our Western professor described it such. Karma is that celestial bank into which is deposited good, which will later be withdrawn and visited upon you. Or it's that bank where bad behavior is deposited and then will later be checked out and visited back to you. Karma, then. Not our New Age Western notion of karma, but for the Hindu, karma is the just visitation of one's own good and bad behavior with their consequences in this or a subsequent life. The whole cycle of rebirths, which culminate in one's journey to enlightenment, is called samsara. Samsara, the whole cycle of rebirths and reincarnations that the individual Atman, the individual personality or soul, which is just an illusion, finally takes, and when he becomes one with the Brahman. It can take many millennia to achieve as well. Hindus are very patient people, and their religion makes them patient. Hindus today still dispute whether there is even an individual soul per se, or whether what we perceive as the individual soul is merely a convergence of the sense, the experience, the knowledge that then dissolves at death. Rebirth, in this case, becomes a kind of force of nature then that shapes the being of subsequent personhood. Did you get all that? Or is your head spinning too, right? Now, many in comparative religious studies are fond of likening karma to the principle of sowing and reaping. The biblical principle of sowing and reaping. There is a biblical principle for this. But there's a trap inherent in it, in comparing these two and saying they're alike. One of the things that really bothers me about Glenn Beck is that he so naively and stupidly, if I can put it that way, embraces this idea. Oh, that's one thing that we have in common with, in Carmen. Yeah. We have in common with Hinduism and New Ageism is this idea of karma and sowing and reaping. Galatians 6 says, do not be deceived. God is not mocked. For whatever one sows, that will he also reap. The one who sows to his own flesh will reap from the flesh corruption. But the one who sows to the Spirit will reap from the Spirit eternal life. Once again, remember, the Hindu notion of karma is that of a mindless principle of the universe that happens like a chemical process of nature, if we can put it that way. The biblical understanding of sowing and reaping, however, involves the very interested participation of the personal, omniscient, and perfectly righteous judge of the universe. Big difference. It is he then who rewards the behavior of each with just, perfectly just and righteous consequences. Fleshly behavior with corrupt consequences, both here and in the hereafter. And spiritual behavior with salutary consequences for the Spirit, by the Spirit, both here and in the world to come. The only correspondence, if you will, between karma and the principle of sowing and reaping is that behavior has consequences. Whoop-de-doo. That's pretty insipid as far as I'm concerned. And you could say that for the whole comparative religion school, too. Pretty insipid. you ever took one in college. So, once more we discover, do we not, as we compare the way of salvation, even what we need to be saved from, between Hinduism and Christianity, we discover the disastrous consequences when the spiritual disease is misdiagnosed in the first place. We've seen this with Islam, with Buddhism, and now with Hinduism. A misdiagnosis means a misprescription. Our problem is not pure souls immersed in ignorance and unenlightenment. Our problem is original sin and spiritual death. We're not perfect souls that are just a shade ignorant around the edges. We are laden with, in our nature, original sin, and we are spiritually dead to all the things of God, not to the things of evil, because there are indeed demons, as Paul says, at the table of Hindus. So there is a living reality, spiritual reality to Hinduism, or else nobody would follow it. But it is a table of demons. Our souls are not just dumb, they're dead. And additionally, as in every pagan system we see, and our souls gravitate to pagan systems, don't they? As fallen human beings, that is our default setting, to gravitate to worshiping demons, to idolatry. As Calvin says, our hearts are factories of idols. We don't have a literal stone, wood, brass, gold, silver image before us, then we create them in our hearts and minds and worship. Not so in biblical Christianity. As Peter declares in Acts chapter 4, there is salvation in no one else. There is biblical exclusivity established for this one. There is salvation in no one else, for there is no other name under heaven given among men by which we must be saved. Dear Mr. Militant Hindu, this is why we say, au contraire. He is not just one of your pantheon of avatars. He is the only and exclusive mediator between God and man. This is why we must stand wherever we must, when not only Muslims resist Christ's exclusive claims to salvation, but also when militant Hindus persecute us. When they persecute a brother in India, they persecute us as well. When they persecute us for refusing to slot the one glorious Savior, the second person of the Holy Trinity, to slot him as just another one of the mere avatars for their understanding of the All, the One, the Brahman, right? So have your head on straight when you go out in your culture, because you have, whether you're aware of it or not, your culture is suffused with Hinduism. We often dismiss it, oh, it's those shallow, lame-brained New Agers. Ha, ha, ha. Their minds have been taken captive, many of them, and they're on the hunt for yours as well. Have your head on straight. Realize with Paul that they are and we were dead in our trespasses and sins in which we once walked, following the course of this world. No course is older or more respected than indeed the world of the Hindu. Following the prince of the power of the air, there's the idea of serving demons, the spirit that is now at work in the sons of disobedience, in which we all live, once in the passions of our flesh. But God, being rich in mercy, because of the great love with which he loved us, here's the intervention of the, indeed, the Hindu has no concept of, the infinite personal God who loved us. By grace you have been saved, Paul says. There's no understanding of this kind of grace in Hinduism either. And raised us up with Christ, by grace you have been saved. For by grace you have been saved, Paul says, through faith. Not works, right? We don't go to our private altars every day and clothe our our little dolls or our little idols and feed them and bathe them, right, and sing songs of love to them. Not a result of works, so that no one may boast. Once again, that clear black line, right, that we draw between biblical Christianity and all other world religions, Hinduism included. For we are his workmanship, created in Christ Jesus for good works, yes, not to get saved, indeed, but as an expression of love for that grace, which God prepared beforehand that we should walk in them. So, brothers and sisters, have your head on straight then. When you go out into the world, have your ear tuned for some of the things we've talked about today. And don't just dismiss your New Age friend, neighbor, relative as some kind of crazy kook, because it's all around us, suffused in practically the water we drink, okay? Well, let us come to that place where we indeed dine at the table of God, not at the table of demons, as we participate in the body and blood of the Lord Jesus Christ in the bread and wine of the supper of the Lord.